Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. Tonight, we continue our conversation with Robert Morrison. He is the Queen's National Scholar at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. And we're continuing to talk about his great history, the Regency years, during which Jane Austen writes, Napoleon fights, Byron makes love, and Britain becomes modern. Rob, welcome back to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book again. As a matter of fact, I'm excited to talk to you about this book again.
Well, I'm thrilled to be back. Thank you so much for asking me, Mark. It's a great pleasure.
Now, one of the things that makes this history so enjoyable for me is that you include really two very different perspectives. First of all, you include a lot of personal things, like what people at that during the Regency would do, like going to the theater, having sex.
Yeah.
But then there's this global perspective that puts it sort of in a much broader context. And I'm fascinated by that. And I want to talk a little bit tonight about Britain on the world stage. And I'm going to skip around a lot, people. So you're going to need to read the book to get the full details. But at the very beginning of the Regency was the end of the Napoleonic Wars. And we can't get into that because if we do, we'll spend the entire...
Oh, please, Mark. Just a little bit of the Napoleonic Wars.
Well, I'll tell you what we're going to talk about because otherwise it'll be the entire program on the Napoleonic Wars. Okay. So, you know, there's Wellington, the Battle of Waterloo, and yes, Everybody's writing about it. Napoleon's a warmongering tyrant and Wellington's an international hero. Yep. But what I found fascinating is Byron.
Yes.
Talk to me about that because that was a very different take on this.
Yeah, well, Lord Byron is an absolutely fascinating character. He's the major poet of the age. When the Regency starts, the major poet is Walter Scott, who after writing very successfully as a poet, reads the poem that makes Byron famous. Byron says very famously in March 1812, "I awoke one morning and found myself famous." And he was famous because he published a poem called Childe Harold's Pilgrimage.
That's right.
And Childe Harold is what it says is Byron in fancy dress. It is an autobiographical account of Byron's trip across the Mediterranean to Albania, to Turkey, to Greece, and so on. And so Byron publishes this in March 1812, and it is immensely popular. And so Walter Scott says, in effect, Byron beat me. And Scott goes on to write novels, and Byron becomes the major poet of the age. He is a lord. It is Lord Byron, but he also has democratic radical sympathies. He's very close friends with Percy Bysshe Shelley, the most radical poet of the age. He's friends with Leigh Hunt, who edits The Examiner, which is the most important, I would say, left-wing publication of the age. And so you have this very famous man who is very conflicted about what's happening in the world around him and who writes brilliantly about it. And once in a while, you get the aristocratic Byron. And the aristocratic Byron, for example, condemns Peterloo. That is the massacre that takes place in Manchester in August 1819. The 200th anniversary of that is coming up. And you get the Byron, who is profoundly democratic in his sympathies. And so Byron, very unexpectedly for me, I think probably for many readers, loathed Wellington. He loathed Wellington. He thought he was a warmongering servant of the monarchy. And even though Byron had ties with, obviously, with the aristocracy and who had met the regent, he deplores what Napoleon is doing in Europe. He deplores war, and he deplores warmongering. And that means he is unable to speak of Wellington without anger. And so you get this very conflicted figure who is distressed. He's profoundly British, but distressed that Napoleon has been defeated. Napoleon is the great, for people like Byron, he is someone who got where he got because of merit, not because he inherited it. And that makes Napoleon, for a lot of people, Shelley and Hazlitt and many others, a very compelling figure.
Wow. There's also a real, what I find a very compelling painting by Turner, J.M.W. Turner, where he visits the fields at Waterloo, and he paints this painting.
Yeah,
I was just studying this painting last night online.
Yeah. It's amazing.
It's an incredibly dark and gloomy, violent painting.
Yeah, it's an amazing portrait. J.M.W. Turner, who features in the book, of course, and who is arguably, I'd say, the most important painter that Britain has ever produced. And Turner is a very, very restless figure. He travels all over the place. And he goes to the fields of Waterloo, as do many, many, many others. Dorothy Wordsworth and a host of others go to see this battle. battlefield. Go to see what they call Wellington's Battlefield, but still called Wellington's Battlefield if you go just south of Brussels. It's in Belgium. Waterloo is in Belgium. Turner paints this picture of the fields of Waterloo. And, there's a picture in the book of Wellington. He's painted by Goya after he wins a battle in 1812. And I write that he looks a haunted man. And you can see in his face, rendered just breathtakingly by Goya, you can see in his face that he has seen atrocities and bloodshed.
He's got what they call the long stare.
Yeah.
For people who've been in war, they have that long stare.
It's what he has gone through is, terrifying and grotesque on level. You know, we're talking about hand-to-hand fighting with bayonets. Those aren't the only weapons that are involved, but, you know, this is a lot of a very close range warfare with all the horrors that you can imagine. And of course, it's been romanticized and glorified and all the rest of it. But when you see Wellington's face, I think it's in a way it's unfair of in many ways it's unfair of Byron. Wellington doesn't look like the war hero who's celebrating yet another victory. He looks horrified by the cost of human life, and he was fighting a battle because he's in the military and he was told to go and fight, so he went and fought. And he fought. The bravery of that guy is just takes your breath away.
Goya's portrait of him, he looks haunted.
Yeah, he looks a haunted man. That's what I say in the book. He looks a haunted man, and he does. And you forget, for example, that I didn't include Goya in the book other than that picture because I concentrated on, if I'd done that, I'd still be working on it.
There's
but
20 books. There's
Beethoven is alive, for example, that Beethoven dedicates something to the regent, that this is an extraordinary time, not just in British history, but in world history. And one of the reasons I ranged outside of Regency Britain is because a lot of people lived in exile or lived out of Regency Britain, but also because I wanted to bring, I wanted to move beyond just the island of Britain.
I find that's why, as I mentioned in the beginning, that's why I find this book so compelling, because it opens, it's like it the telescope sort of broadens and you see it. And one of the things I found very compelling was you're writing about the War of 1812. Now, bracketing this, I have to say that, you don't learn that much about the War of 1812 here in the grade school, which is the first time I ever heard of it. It sort of went by really fast, and I can't remember that much about it.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for people to realize that this was a war where America decided it wanted to take on Canada.
Yeah. It did.
It was a war of aggression by America trying to, let's take Canada.
Yeah, let's just go take Canada. Yeah. So I have to say that the War of 1812, when I went through grade school, didn't get a lot of attention. It gets more attention now. Got more attention, for example, when my children went through. The War of 1812 is going on at the same time as the Napoleonic Wars. Britain is fighting in Europe, and then it's got this other war going on in North America. And as I try to outline in the book, it's inevitably from one perspective a bit of a sideshow to the massive struggle going on in Europe. But from another perspective, it plays an enormous role in defining America. It plays, I would say, an equally enormous role in defining, what Canada is, what Canada might stand for, what Canada might stand for, different from America, the same as America. It in many ways defines the future of the North American continent from the settlement, the Treaty of Ghent, until today. The other thing I try to say about the Battle of 1812 is that for the indigenous people of North America, this was a catastrophe. Catastrophe.
I wanted to just pause a moment because I don't think enough people on this side of the pond realize that this is also a war that the United States, the War Hawks in U.S. Congress, called for the eradication of what was called indigenous resistance.
That's right. That's right. The indigenous peoples are led at one point by a great indigenous leader named Tecumseh, and Tecumseh is killed at in one of the earlier battles, and the indigenous confederacy that he hoped to found that would go essentially from Lake Ontario, where I am sitting now, on the banks of Lake Ontario, down to the Gulf of Mexico, and that would be the indigenous lands. That is, that America wouldn't move any further west, Canada wouldn't move any further west than the boundary of the Ohio, and he was killed. And the indigenous confederacy and his dream of that confederacy fell apart. And, you know, the story of what happened to those people, I think is becoming better known. But if my book could accomplish one thing, it would be to raise awareness about that war and what happened to the indigenous people as a result of it. I want it to do many, many other things, but, you know, speaking as a North American, speaking as Canadian, that war defined an awful lot. And it happened during the Regency when the White House, or what became the White House, was burned. You know, the British soldiers toasted the Prince Regent. And when I decided I wanted to write this book, I came across things like that, and I thought, you know, can you imagine in 1813 these people in what was the Executive Mansion drinking wine that was supposed to be for the victorious American soldiers, that became for British soldiers, and they toasted the Prince Regent. The other thing I just want to say quickly about the War of 1812 is that I was rereading Mansfield Park, Austin's Mansfield Park, and you'll perhaps recall, Mark, that the section on the War of 1812 begins with a quotation from Jane Austen, because she mentions it in Mansfield Park, and I thought, I really want to write a book that says Jane Austen had one eye on the War of 1812. That's not necessarily how we think of her, and I think that she is just a far more fascinating and complicated and aware figure than sometimes is allowed.
You have such a crush on her.
I do have a crush on Jane Austen. She's just fantastic.
Okay,
she's
stop there.
The
stop.
Woman.
Stop it. Stop it, Rob. Stop it.
All right.
My favorite quote that you put in the book about the War of 1812 was from Lieutenant John Le Couteau, which is a hot and unnatural war between kindred people.
There, that's what it was.
It just amounted to, it was a lot of shit that happened, and then it was over, and nothing was really done.
Nothing was resolved at all. And it was, you know, I think it's worth mentioning, it was Canadians fighting Americans. That doesn't make any sense at all.
It doesn't.
You know, I think all war is, of course, is appalling. Le Couture said that this was a hot and unnatural war between kindred people. And that's a way of thinking about that long, long border that divides Canada and America.
That's right.
And, you know, it's unarmed. And I think that's something that Canadians and Americans can be very proud of.
Now, this is also a time period, and I found this section of the book really fascinating, where Britain is really, and British people are traveling around the world. British interests are asserting themselves around the world. It's a time of tremendous imperialist designs from Britain all around the world.
Yes.
And there's a lot that goes on. Let's just give a couple of examples. Let's talk about the British East India Company at this time. It was founded in 1600.
Yep.
But during the Regency, really, there's a lot that's written about British life in India by different people. It becomes the focus of novels. It becomes the focus of all sorts of stuff.
Yes. Well, Britain, the East India Company is sort of founded as a, you know, as a trading company to further British interests in trade. But before long, it gets its own army, and it becomes, you know, one of the most potent arms of British imperialist designs. And one of the things that really came across to me very clearly, especially in the journals of people who were living in India, like Maria Graham and Lady Nugent during the Regency, is that these people believed sincerely, I think, or at least part with some sincerity anyway, that they were doing the peoples of India, for example, a really big favor. that is, the peoples of India were living, you know, without a Protestant God, and they were living without, you know, a thorough knowledge of Christianity, and they were living, you know, this sort of existence that didn't have a Christian God in it. And they went to help and to save those people. And some imperialists genuinely believed that. And so there are comments by the two women I've mentioned in particular about how the people seem a lot happier in the areas where Britain has been settled longer. And, you know, that's because of Christianity, and that's because the Britons know how to build roads, and that's because the Britons know about civilization. And these people in India really aren't very civilized, and so they need British help. And so on the back of that sort of altruism, or, you know, faux altruism, or whatever you want to say, you know, comes greed, corruption, perversion, and imperialist expansion, which brings war and disease and alcohol and all the rest of it. And anybody in North America knows that story, and it happens in India as well.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Tonight, we continue our conversation with Robert Morrison, the Queen's National Scholar at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. And we're talking about his book. It is the best kind of history. The Regency years, during which Jane Austen writes, Napoleon fights, Byron makes love, and Britain becomes modern. Rob, I want to talk about China and Britain and China, but first I want to talk about opium during the Regency period.
Okay.
Opium was really the drug of choice during the Regency.
Well, my last book was on a man named Thomas de Quincey. It was a biography of a man named Thomas de Quincey. And in 1821, de Quincey published something called Confessions of an English Opium Eater. And this is widely seen as the first modern drug memoir. So, for example, W.S. Burroughs says, you know, the first and best book on drug addiction was written by de Quincey. And de Quincey sinks down into opium addiction in the Regency, 1813. He says, I became a regular and confirmed opium eater. Now, opium, as perhaps, is taken in the form of what's called laudanum, which is opium dissolved in alcohol. And doctors prescribed it for absolutely everything from cancer to hay fever. And people, it was legal, and it was very cheap. It was cheaper than beer. It was cheaper than gin. And it was, everybody sold it. And you could buy it in pills. You could buy it in any way you wanted. And unsurprisingly, you took it, and you felt a lot better. However, there was a problem, obviously, because then when you stopped taking it, you went into what 100 years later was called withdrawal, what we now would call withdrawal. But back then, people had no idea about withdrawal. So you took it to get rid of, you know, rheumatic pains. You stopped taking it, and the pains came back, and they were a little bit different. But so you end up in this horrible, horrible cycle where you are taking opium to get rid of the pain of that's being inflicted by opium. And that's a very short step to addiction. And in the end of the 19th century, of course, opium becomes much better known as one of, in the form of one of its chief derivatives, and that is heroin.
That's right.
And heroin now, I don't know what word to pick to describe what's happening around the world with the opioid epidemic. Heroin, laudanum, fentanyl, all these versions, synthetic some of them, but all these are versions of opium. And obviously, everybody knows about the devastation it's inflicting in Canada, in Africa, in America, all over the world. And that addiction, that fascination with drugs, that, you know, the Regency did lots of good things. It also did that.
Now, where was the source for Britain's opium? Was it China?
No, it wasn't China. Britain moved a lot of opium into China, but Britain most often traded Britain forced the opium on China, which produced three different wars. But Britain gave them opium and then took tea. So, you know, the phrase, I can hear my mother, my grandmother saying, all the tea in China. Well, wow. The tea in China, it came from Britain selling them opium, taking China. Britain got its opium from Turkey because it was stronger and because it was closer.
Now, so Britain also, though, has expanding interests in China at this time, India, in places like Java. And it's also this time period is when there's a lot of settlement in Australia, in New South Wales. And these are not your usual settlers.
No. Australia in 1792, Sydney in Australia, becomes a penal colony. Britain has got what's called the Bloody Code, which will put you in prison or hang you for virtually anything. And that means when you're over 6 years old, if you cut down a tree and are caught, the penalty is capital punishment. The penalty is the death penalty. So it means that the prison population is just out of control. They don't have a very reliable or very professional police force. That doesn't happen until 1829. And so the Regency is sort of the last decade of just sort of unbridled criminality. The Dickens who writes, Oliver Twist and novels like that is creating that version of Regency London. And because the prison population is so high, people are put on hulks, which are, disused ships that just sit in the Thames River, and there are 600 people. You just lock them up on the ship. And then Britain decides, well, we're just going to ship them off to Australia. So they literally put these people on a ship in appalling conditions and send them to Australia. And so in the 1790s, a penal colony in Australia is founded and gets moving. And by the Regency, 1811, it's, a fairly small town, but it is thriving. People go there, their sentences are commuted or whatever, or they serve their sentence in Australia, and then they're allowed, then they're freed. Some of them go back to Britain. Many of them stay in Australia. And by the end of the period, colonialist expansion in Australia, with the same devastating consequences for indigenous peoples, is well underway. Britain was colonizing everywhere. It's a tiny little island, Mark.
I know.
So where is it getting its wealth? And the answer is, it's got cheap labor at home, and it's got the Thames River, and it's bringing goods and people from around the world into London.
There is a natural event that occurs that you write about in your book that I find fascinating, the way that it affected. And that is on April 5th, 1815, Mount Tambora explodes. Talk about that.
Well, this is, in the Indonesian archipelago, there's a volcano, Mount Tambora, and it explodes, and it really explodes. It's the most devastating explosion, 10 times more powerful than Krakatoa. And what it does is it blasts all this soot and dust and sand, volcanic ash, up into the atmosphere. And of course, now we can follow these things. But back then, nobody knew what the consequence was of a volcano exploding with that ferocity. And, with that much devastation, tens of thousands of people die very, very quickly. The ash goes up into the air, and what it does is it puts sort of a cloud between the earth and the sun. And in the summer of 1816, that summer is known as the year without summer, because summer just didn't come. It just rained the whole time. And so when I was investigating this, Samuel Taylor Coleridge is talking about the weather. Jane Austen is talking about the weather.
That's right.
Everybody's talking about the weather. And for me, it was a moment when I really sort of... sounds silly, but I really fell in love with the book I was writing, because I thought, John Turner and Jane Austen and Samuel Taylor Coleridge and James Mill are all getting wet this summer. But the crucial thing is that Shelley and Byron, that is Mary Shelley and Percy Shelley and Byron and John Pollard are in Switzerland. And the weather is so terrible that they stay inside and write ghost stories. And that's why we get Frankenstein, and that's why we get Polidori's The Vampire. Byron challenged them to a ghost story competition because this volcano exploded, halfway around the world.
What an amazing thing. What an incredible thing. This one explosion on one part of the world affects the entire planet.
And so you get this sense that, one of the reasons that there is the chapter on internationalism is because, you get this sense that the world is waking up to its interconnectedness.
That's right.
Sometimes that interconnectedness comes through colonial expansion, and sometimes that interconnectedness comes, through natural catastrophe, and sometimes it comes because people in America, people in Canada, people in India fall in love with Walter Scott or fall in love with Lord Byron, and so by his poet, by his literature, so you get international celebrities. Lord Byron is an international celebrity.
And then there's the Brighton Pavilion.
And the Brighton Pavilion. Yes, let's talk about the Brighton Pavilion.
We just have a few minutes left, but you have to talk about it, because this is part of that whole passion for what was called at the time Orientalism. Orientalism, where it permeates every aspect of Regency culture.
Every, It is going to visit. I mean, I've been to the Brighton Pavilion before. I went with a dear friend a few years into writing the book, and it is the most mind-boggling building I have ever been in. You just cannot believe that this tribute to Eastern architecture, Eastern style, Eastern color patterns, Eastern is the most symbolic. A representation of Regency Britain in the world, in Britain, for sure. It is an Eastern building that best symbolizes the British Regency. And to me, that's just fascinating. And that's driven by the Regent, who admired Eastern architecture, Eastern ingenuity, Eastern imagination, Eastern culture.
We only have like 2 minutes left. And
you better ask me about Beau Brummel, man. You better ask me.
Oh, man, because that's going to have to be another interview. Because I was going to ask you about the Luddites.
Come on, like a weekly basis, Mark.
I know. I was going to talk about the Luddites because this was the era that the Luddites happened. We still use that same. We still talk about Ludditism.
Yeah.
And we still use it. And this was part of a whole reaction against the industrialization that was started.
That's right. That industrialization is taking away people's jobs. Like, you know, technology and robotics are taking away people's jobs now. A Luddism now, I think, you know, means, you know, dislike of technology.
It's more like anti-technology.
Anti-technology, yes. Then it was just that people didn't want to lose their job. I don't think it necessarily meant, well, it didn't mean that people were against technology. People were against being hungry, and people were losing their jobs on a massive scale. The families that for generations had made their living as weavers and artisans were being put out of work by these big factories that we know from Dickens's novels. But one thing about the Regency is it shows a way in which, you know, that Dickens is not writing about something that's just happened. The Regency is a period where there are big factories, where there is child labor, and where you know, a few people get very wealthy, and thousands of people are forced into the factory, out of their homes in English villages, and into factories. And the conditions in the factories are appalling.
I think the amazing thing is everything we talked about is in this book.
Yeah.
So people who are listening to this, this sounds like about six different books. No,
well, wanted to give people a sense of the world.
That's why I said this is one of my favorite histories. It's all woven together in one tapestry, and that's why you need to read this book. Tonight, we've been continuing our conversation with Robert Morrison, the Queen's National Scholar at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. And his book is The Regency Years, during which Jane Austen writes, Napoleon fights, Byron makes love, and Britain becomes modern. And you're going to have to read the book to learn about Beau Brummel. Otherwise, we're going to have to do another interview just about Beau Brummel.
I'm ready.
I want you to write a book about Beau Brummel. That's what I want.
There's a very good book about Beau Brummel already, but I'll think about it.
Think about it. Thank you so much, Rob. I want more histories like this. This makes sense to me. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICN. 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.